What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I have recurring guest Luke Mikich. He's the man. He's been absolutely bullish, so I had to get him on to see just how bullish he is. So be sure to be tuned in for another great, great episode. But first, a little housekeeping notes. I am thinking of consolidating the podcast into one podcast feed. I'm curious of what you guys think. So if you guys could tweet at me or shoot me a DM or let me know. But I'm thinking of moving the State of Bitcoin podcast to the Macro Insights feed and just keep it all in one and kind of make it easier for those listening on both ends. But let me know what you guys think. I've been pondering it for a little bit. Regardless, hit that subscribe button here so you get all the notifications when this podcast comes through. And remember that this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And big shout out to my sponsors. Shout out to the Bitcoin Advisor, my man, Peter Dunworth and his team, including myself, are allowing you to HODL Bitcoin in a secure fashion. We can help you set up multi-sig, collaborative custody, or even an IRA and some estate planning as well. So check us out at thebitcoinadvisor.com/greencandle. And shout out to HODLers Official. That's HODLERSOfficial.com. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE to get any of the jerseys 10% off your entire order. If you want to buy a bunch of them, you can get 10% off for the whole thing. So be sure to be tuned in for that. All right, now let's get back to the show. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Luke Mikich, who's going to tell us why he believes there's going to be a super cycle in 2025, even without the ETF. We're recording this right after the SEC debacle, tweeting out the ETF is approved, then backtracking. We're going to get all into that. But first, Luke, how you doing, man?
Welcome. I'm doing great, brother. I'm absolutely pumped to be here. So I'm ready to get bullish with you.
Yeah, man. All right. First, we got to talk about it because we just alluded to it. You know, all this hubbub that was going on. It seems like the market is screaming for a Bitcoin ETF. And the SEC tweeted out today that it is approved. And then they backtracked, said they got their Twitter got hacked, deleted the tweet. What do you have to make of all of, you know, what transpired today? You know, now that we're recording this on January 9th.
Yeah. So essentially, for anyone tuning in after the fact, we are recording 1 hour after Gary Gensler sent out the tweet from the SEC official account saying a Bitcoin spot ETF was approved. And so much has happened in that last hour. I think it's really interesting watching what the price has done. I don't normally watch the charts very often, but Bitcoin pumped up to 48,000, back down to 44,000. I've seen a few people speculate that maybe this was an inside job. Maybe Gary or maybe someone associated with the SEC account who has access to the account sent out the tweet and they kind of used it to, you know, make a little bit of money on a leveraged trade. I don't know. I don't have any strong opinions on what's just happened because it's still so fresh, so new, but it is all happening. And it's hilarious watching all the memes dunking on the SEC right now and how they're not protecting investors because that's their core mandate. But look at what the price is doing from the lack of their very own competence.
Yeah, it's hilarious too, because exactly like you said, they preach about market manipulation, you know, protecting investors. But, you know, Walker at Walker America tweeted out the timeline. So I'll read it out here based on his tweet at 3:11. The SEC, the official account tweets, all Bitcoin ETFs are approved. Then 15 minutes later at 3:26, Gary Gensler tweets from his account that the SEC account was hacked. Then allegedly at 3:38 p.m., the SEC, quote unquote, regains control of their account and deletes the original tweet. And then at 3:42, the SEC tweets that they were hacked and have not approved the ETFs.
seems like something's fishy there. But what do you have to make of, like, you know, the SEC's claim that, you know, at the end of the day, they don't, you know, they're here to protect investors. You know, the stock market isn't manipulated. Like, what do you have to take of all of these traditional markets, you know, trying to come into Bitcoin, which they've said is, you know, quote unquote, a manipulated market. You know, there's it's used for nefarious things like, you know, drug running and all these things. But it seems like the SEC at the end of the day is kind of the character that, you know, is, you know, making these market manipulations just by a simple tweet. So it is obviously hypocritical, but what do you have to make of, I guess, the SEC's role, not only in this Bitcoin ETF, but, you know, in the stock market in general?
Yeah, so the SEC capitulating and being forced to approve a Bitcoin ETF is the biggest signal that, you know, the Bitcoin super cycle is coming, okay? These billionaires want Bitcoin exposure. They need Bitcoin exposure. BlackRock reportedly has billions of dollars of capital lined up to flow into its Bitcoin ETF in the first week. You know, these are just rumors, but I think, you know, in the first year, you're going to be looking at a whole lot of Bitcoin being bought by these Bitcoin ETF, you know, issuers, because the billionaires need Bitcoin exposure. They've watched what Michael Saylor just did over the past 3 years as he put on an absolute clinic in the Bitcoin space. This dude bought the top, he bought the bottom, he bought Bitcoin at 9K, bought it at 55K. But today he's sitting on $1 billion profit for his company over at MicroStrategy. He owns 190,000 Bitcoin over at MicroStrategy. He nearly holds 1% of the total supply. Michael Saylor is putting on an absolute clinic. And now the rest of Wall Street is capitulating. They're saying we need Bitcoin ETF exposure. We need Bitcoin exposure. So I think I don't really look into the SEC too much. I just look at the broader signal that this is sending. And this is saying, hey, look, the world's billionaires are finally interested in actually buying some Bitcoin. So if BlackRock is out there, you know, marketing for Bitcoin and applying to get a Bitcoin spot ETF, this is wildly bullish for Bitcoin.
Oh, 100%. But, you know, we alluded to it at the beginning. You believe that there could be a super cycle without the ETF. So, all right, why do you think without the ETF there could be a super cycle? Because as you lined out, right, the rumor is there's $1 billion, maybe even more, sitting on the sidelines in BlackRock. Of course, this is all a rumor, but obviously $1 billion of influx would extremely benefit, you know, Bitcoin and the price, and that number will go up. But on the flip side, if it doesn't need the ETF, why do you think that we'll see a super cycle in 2025?
Yeah, so completely, you know, ignore all of the ETFs. I think it all comes down to supply and demand. And I've been beating the drum for the past 3 years, screaming that something changed in 2020. So for the past 4 years, what you've watched is coins leave the exchanges at a precipitous rate. So for the first 12 years of Bitcoin's life, between 2008 and 2020, you only saw the amount of Bitcoin sitting on exchanges increase. So we saw that amount grow from 0 to 3.1 million Bitcoin. Since March of 2020, when the money printers were turned on in the COVID crash, we saw an inflection point. And since March of 2020, there's only, you know, 2 million Bitcoin sitting on exchanges today. So you've watched 1.1 million Bitcoin fly off exchanges and into the hands of long-term holders. Today, long-term holders, they're holding more and more Bitcoin than ever before. I believe 80% of all the Bitcoin has not moved in the past year. So I actually did a video a little while ago explaining what the Bitcoin double halving is. So I coined that term and I was looking at what kind of effect the Bitcoin halving is going to have. Because most people in the Bitcoin space believe that we're going to see diminishing returns in Bitcoin. Because they're saying, look, the amount of Bitcoin that is halved every 4 years is getting smaller and smaller. So this is going to have a smaller and a smaller impact when you compare the supply shock against the circulating amount of Bitcoin available for sale. So again, this is I did like a 25-minute video explaining this, so I'll try to keep this as brief as possible. But I think that's the wrong way to analyze what kind of shock the halvings are going to have. I don't think you should be looking at the circulating supply of Bitcoin, because not all the coins are actually available for sale. Okay, so the circulating supply of Bitcoin today is 19.5 million Bitcoin. That's what we're told. But we know only 2 or 3 million Bitcoin are actually available for sale. So what I did was, in this video explaining what the double halving is, I went back through every single Bitcoin halving, 2012, 2016, 2020, and I projected out to 2024. And what I did differently was I said, let's not look at the supply of Bitcoin that's mined at the time of each halving to analyze the supply shock. Let's look at how many Bitcoin are actually available on exchanges and how many Bitcoin are classified as highly liquid. So they're the Bitcoins that are actually available for sale. And when you run those numbers, you actually find something very interesting, because for the first time in Bitcoin's life, the past 4 years, we've watched this supply suffocation. We have less Bitcoin sitting on exchanges. So for the first time in Bitcoin's life, we're about to see a halving where we have 4 years of data of decreasing supply available for sale. So when you actually run the numbers, you see essentially a double halving in 2024. The year-over-year supply shock we're going to see in 2024 is the same shock we saw in 2020. So it actually didn't halve at all. So I believe that 2024 is setting up for a Bitcoin double halving. And I just believe Bitcoin is a monetary technology. Technologies get adopted in these exponential curves. And I think it's only a matter of time that we see a super cycle in one of these Bitcoin cycles. So I wrote an article in 2021 saying, look, I think this is going to happen in 2021. I said there's a 30% probability it happens this time in 2021. I was obviously wrong. Okay, Bitcoin crashed when the Fed started raising interest rates aggressively. But my case was, look, Bitcoin's a macro asset now. It's being bought by nation states like El Salvador. It's on the balance sheet of public companies like MicroStrategy. You know, these theories of diminishing returns are an absolute meme. I've said a lot. I'll shut up for a minute and let you back in and tell me if any of that makes sense.
No, it all makes sense. But I agree with you 100% there, because you know what, it's something that I've been saying for quite some time as well, is that Bitcoin at the end of the day, you know, the halvings are going to mean less and less as we get farther along in Bitcoin's life cycle, just simply because, you know, the supply and demand, it's something like, you know, what, 8 or 9% of total Bitcoin that is left to be mined, where, you know, at the end of the day, is 8 or 9% of the total supply left going to control the entire market price? I don't think so. It just seems unrealistic for that small of a fraction. It's more about the hodler's behavior, exactly like you're saying, right? Some people will take their Bitcoin to the grave, or some people will send Bitcoin to Satoshi's wallet. I kind of saw a meme like that going around this past week. So, you know, at the end of the day, people just want to make sure that, you know, Bitcoin's going to live because of their belief in the hard money principles. And, you know, that belief is stronger than any dollar amount that they can really see. So I think, you know, one thing that we are seeing right now that is pretty interesting is that Bitcoin's price is starting to run more off of Bitcoin specific news opposed to just macro news, right? So we're going to get this, you know, I guess, great little cocktail where it's going to be not only the ETF news, which we saw the pump today when it was allegedly approved for like 6 minutes. We saw a big giant pump and then a big giant crash down. But not only that, right? We're going to have interest rates drop this year, which will lead to more money in quote unquote risk on assets. And hedge fund managers are going to start to look for something like that. So on not only that, you know, we have the ETF, more money coming in, hodler's behavior, and interest rates coming down, along with the halving, right? I mean, the halving will be kind of a part of it and be a kind of a price driver. But I think at the end of the day, exactly like you said, I think it's more about the hodler's behavior and somewhat of the macro environment is going to affect it less and less. So I start to see that decoupling happening over a long period of time. But on the flip side of things, we're still in a fiat world. So do you think that this is the last cycle and that this cycle is going to be the super cycle?
Yeah, I think so. I said there's a 30% chance in 2021 cycle. I think there's probably like a 50% chance it happens this cycle. So again, nothing's a certainty. Anybody who tells you that they know exactly where the price of Bitcoin going, they're a liar, they're a fraud. Their name is probably Gareth Soloway, and they're probably trying to sell you some bloody trading course. Okay, but nobody knows where the price of Bitcoin is going. Neither do I. But I am more confident in 2024 than I was in 2021 when I wrote that article, that we are going to see a super cycle in 2025. Like you say, it is a perfect storm. We have all the catalysts laying there. We have a supply shock. We have a demand shock. We have absolutely everything happening. We have Uncle Larry Fink, who's about to spend millions of dollars advertising Bitcoin. Okay, I think Pompliano did a podcast the other day. I listen to it every now and then from time to time. He's got some okay takes when he's not talking about crypto. And he said that he believes that between the ETF issuers, you're going to see $100 million of ad spend on for Bitcoin in the next couple of years. That's massive. Like, I think Wall Street have filled their bags. I think the past 3 years have all been an attack on Bitcoin to actually suppress the price and let Wall Street fill up their bags. Think about it. We had FTX naked short 80,000 Bitcoin in 2022. They were supposed to have 80,000 Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and they didn't. And we even got the inside leak and the inside scoop coming out of FTX when Caroline said that, yeah, we were trying to suppress the price of Bitcoin under $20,000 by selling Bitcoin. Sam directly told me to suppress the price of Bitcoin under 20K. So now that we don't have any FTX, we don't have any of that fake, you know, naked shorting paper Bitcoin games going on with Sam Bankman-Fried in the Bahamas. I think the coming year could be very, very interesting for Bitcoin. It's everything's lining up for it to be a perfect year.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that there's going to be, it's the SEC and like other regulators are making it harder for issuers of quote unquote paper Bitcoin. And I agree with you 100%. But one thing I do worry about with this ETF, right, is that there is a lot of demand. Right. And there's obviously not the SEC just kind of proved that they don't have a lot of competence. They can't even keep their own Twitter account, you know, secure. So do you believe that the SEC or not the SEC, but this new ETF might almost take place of FTX? I'm not saying that the like BlackRock's going to do anything nefarious or anything like that, but I don't know if the SEC has the capability to audit and make sure that BlackRock has as much Bitcoin as they say. And I'm not quite sure about the regulations between spot ETFs. If, you know, some of these billion dollars, if they need to come in and, you know, need to have a 1,000 or 100% of, you know, whatever everybody buys of this ETF, or if it's just a fractional percentage, you know, which could also kind of suppress the price as well. If, you know, the demand for this ETF is, I don't know, I'm just throwing out random numbers, but like 10,000 shares, for example, and the BlackRock only purchases 1,000 coins, so to speak.
So I'm no expert in the ETF realm, and I am more conspiratorial than most. I've done many videos explaining why this BlackRock Bitcoin ETF should not be trusted, and I've even speculated why it could be an attack on Bitcoin. But I believe that these ETF issuers are actually held to a very, very high standard from my very limited knowledge about the space. I try to learn as much as I can from some people who are, you know, far more educated in the ETF realm. And it sounds as if they are held to a pretty high standard. But I won't trust that even if you come out with like an audit, I would still be like slightly skeptical. Okay, do we trust these numbers or not? I don't know, but I think it will be pretty easy to verify because we can just simply look at the coins on exchanges and the coins held by Coinbase custody, and we can know pretty clearly like whether there's Bitcoin being ripped off exchanges by these Bitcoin ETF issuers who do have to buy the Bitcoin. That is another big misconception in the space right now. There's a lot of jargon going around with this cash in kind redemption and all of this other stuff. Some people think that the ETF issuers don't have to buy real Bitcoin because it's cash in, cash out ETFs. But no, they have to buy the actual Bitcoin to back up their shares. So I'm not sure. I mean, I don't trust anyone as far as I can throw them. And even if BlackRock comes out with some sort of audit, I'm still probably going to be slightly skeptical. And it's good to be on the offensive and always looking at how things could go wrong. But I think I think if you had to put a gun to my head, I think it's wildly bullish for Bitcoin. And I think this is only going to accelerate the supply shock.
No, 100%. I think you're nailing it on the head, and I'm putting you on the spot here with a little SEC like ETF little quiz. But I want to get back to the hodler's behavior, right? I mean, you know, you've been traveling around, you've been doing the digital nomad stuff with you and your girlfriend. It's great content. So if you guys aren't following them, you should definitely check out all the things that they're doing. You know, you were in Argentina when Javier Milei won, like all these great things. But from a broad stroke perspective, you've been traveling around a bunch. What do you take of Bitcoin adoption? You know, I mean, you've been traveling in Latin America a bunch. Like, you know, what from that, from like the price perspective or the overall macro environment of Bitcoin, are people starting to pick up a little bit more, you know, when it comes to, I guess, Bitcoin adoption, just the medium of exchange aspect of it? Or do you think, you know, we're still kind of in this, I guess, Western mindset where we're thinking more about the number go up opposed to the medium of exchange?
I can tell you what, it is so much easier trying to orange pill someone in Latin America, even with my very limited, you know, repertoire of Spanish. My Spanish is very rusty, but I still have an easier time orange pilling people on Bitcoin here than I do in Western countries like America and Australia. And that is simply because people in Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, they've had the shittiest currency for a long time. You know, they're not dealing with 5 or 15% inflation like we see in the West. They're dealing with 20 to 50% inflation. And in Argentina's case, 250% inflation, okay? The local grill that we go to, the Pam and myself, they actually have stickers on their menu and they would change the prices on like a weekly basis. That's how bad inflation is in Argentina. And that's why adoption in Argentina seems like really high. Like there are companies out there who are willingly wanting to accept Bitcoin as well as quote unquote crypto. So like nearly our first night we landed in Argentina, we just booked a massage or a random massage place. They had the most reviews in our area. So we said, we'll book a massage with these guys. And then when we were actually talking to them on WhatsApp, you know, coordinating the place that we would get the massage, they said, how would you like to pay? Can you pay us in crypto? And we were shocked. We were like, hang on a minute. Somebody actually asked us to pay them in crypto first. We said we'll be paying with a Bitcoin Lightning Network if you've got it. Thank you. And they did. So it's really, really interesting to see that in a country that doesn't have Bitcoin, you know, as legal tender, like we see in El Salvador. Like, it's amazing to be able to spend Bitcoin every day in El Salvador, but that is because, you know, the government put a lot of time, effort, and money into pushing the country in a certain direction. In Argentina, I could spend Bitcoin and even stable coins, but this is because the little guy wants to use it. This is not because the government's saying, hey, look, you have to do it. Like, the little guy in Argentina is actually, you know, adopting Bitcoin, which is amazing to see. So it's pretty interesting to watch Argentina do what it's doing. And it looks as if many countries are trying to copy the playbook of Bukele. And he has absolutely transformed that country in El Salvador. I am in El Salvador right now. I flew back here for Christmas. And it's an amazing country. Every time I come to El Salvador, it's improved, which is amazing. And, you know, spending Bitcoin every day, it's a dream come true.
Yeah, it's amazing. I blacked it out for a second. My bad. I went off camera, unclicked the wrong button. But I mean, yeah, all that makes complete sense. But, you know, it is interesting because, and I want to take it back to, I guess, more the Western perspective of Bitcoin, because I guess not only Bitcoin, but El Salvador, right? Because obviously El Salvador made it legal tender. You already alluded to that. You're in El Salvador now. But another thing that El Salvador did was hold Bitcoin on their own, you know, country's balance sheet. And so, you know, the past couple of years, everybody in traditional finance on financial Twitter was dunking on Bukele, like, oh, you bought Bitcoin, your average price was, you know, in the 30,000s, and Bitcoin dropped all the way down to 15. Well, now Bukele's looking a little bit smarter, right? I mean, do you think that that's going to start to come around where, you know, obviously El Salvador is doing a lot better since Bukele became president, but not only that, they're going to make an absolute killing probably in this next bull run from that Bitcoin that they've been purchasing. So do you think that is going to turn more heads than maybe, I guess, like anything else is like going to see the return on the quote unquote investment that Bukele is making when it came to putting Bitcoin on his balance sheet?
Hot take? No, not to the normies. But I think what it is going to do is it's going to wake up those people who are on the fence and are mildly open to Bitcoin. So when Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy Bitcoin strategy is, you know, in the green like it is today, I believe this is now going to wake up those public companies who watched what Michael did in 2020 and they just weren't quite as brave as him to actually pull the trigger on it. So I think it will eventually ripple out and, you know, reach the masses, because now when El Salvador's Bitcoin treasury is in the green and it's in so much profit, all of a sudden, I believe the countries that were more Bitcoin curious and watched Bukele very closely in 2021, I believe those are the ones that are going to actually pull the trigger in the coming year or so when Bukele's Bitcoin playbook is well and truly in the green. I believe they are in the green right now. And Bukele, like the Chad he is, actually created a video. It's like a 4-minute video in Spanish, published it on his Twitter and, you know, spread it around the country, trying to explain to the people of El Salvador, hey, this is why we don't sell our Bitcoin. Look, the country's treasury is actually in the profit today. If you had held your $30 that I gave you 2 years ago, you'd be in the green today. And, you know, he said, hey, look, we're not selling our Bitcoin. We're holding it. It's really, really cool to see him, you know, put that little video together. And that's certainly going to grab the attention of other nations who might be a little bit curious. I saw recently this week, actually, Prospera, which is a little region in Honduras, came out and they said they're like recognizing Bitcoin as a unit of account or something like that. That was really interesting. I might do a video on that. But I think Honduras is just, you know, one example of many other little Bitcoin economies around the world beginning to take note of what Bukele is doing. So I don't think Bukele's Bitcoin strategy is going to wake up the masses, but the masses are going to be woken up by the next wave of 3 to 5 nation states who do something similar to what Bukele has done.
Yeah, and I think you're right there, because I think everybody's kind of like discredited El Salvador, at least tried to within you know, the time period of them making Bitcoin legal tender. But the one big signal, you know, I mean, we talked about it at the beginning, we've already talked about it a little bit a couple times, is the overall price, right? So the number go up, as that's what's making the headlines. So we've talked about the bull cycle, and we've talked about this being potentially a super cycle. You said 50% chance. So then, you know, I guess in this cycle, if you believe it's going to be a super cycle, then are you like Michael Saylor? Is it going to go up forever, Laura? Or do you have a price target you're looking at in this next cycle?
I think $900,000 is a really interesting price for Bitcoin. So I think obviously your diminishing returns maximalists are going to get wrecked. So Bitcoin's going to get up to 150 or 200K. All of those bros who have been talking about diminishing returns are going to sell their Bitcoin. Bitcoin's going to have a 30% correction. They're going to be screaming, hey, look, we were right. Maybe even Gareth Soloway will come out of the woodwork then and he will say, hey, look, I've got a 100X leverage short open on Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin will rip. It'll take its all-time high again. All the people who sold will FOMO. And you just watch volatility get even more crazy like it did in 2017. If somebody pull up a chart of what the Bitcoin price did in 2017, had like 8 corrections of 30% or more. Every single correction, everybody thought the price of Bitcoin had topped and it was all over. And they had good reason to believe it because the chart was parabolic. But the interesting thing about parabolas is they always go higher than most people believe them to go. So I've seen lots of people, you know, think the average, you know, Bitcoin's going to hit 100K to 200K this cycle. That's like the average consensus. I've seen a few bulls believe it's going to hit, you know, 500K, 600K, maybe even 700K. But I haven't seen many people suggest that Bitcoin's going to hit $1 million. Our friend Samson Mao believes Bitcoin's going to go to $1 million in the space of a couple of days or weeks. And I actually think that is less crazy than many people are saying it is. Okay, if Bitcoin is globally adopted by the world, it is only a matter of time before we see an omega candle, a $1 million daily Bitcoin candle. It is going to happen. It is maths. It is not crazy. It is not bullish hopium dealing. It is simply going to happen. You have $900 trillion of wealth in the world. Bitcoin today is like $800 billion in size. Is it really that crazy to suggest Bitcoin could do a $1 million daily candle? I don't think so. Not when you actually put it in market cap terms. because like a $1 million candle, it sounds a lot crazier than like, say, a what would it have to be? Like a $1 trillion flow into Bitcoin? I don't know the exact numbers. I haven't run the exact numbers for this one. But I think this coming cycle is going to be really interesting. So when I say there's a 50% chance that we see a super cycle, I think a super cycle would be any price over $400,000 to $500,000. So I think most people expect Bitcoin to hit somewhere around 100 to 300. Super cycle is higher. And I think a super cycle also implies that you don't get a big 80% correction. And I said the exact same thing in the last cycle. In the last cycle, I also said there's a 30% chance that we don't get these big 85% corrections in Bitcoin. We still got like a 75% correction. So I'm counting that as me being wrong as well. But I think there is a price or a market cap that Bitcoin reaches where you don't see a 70 or 80 or 85% correction ever again. And I think maybe that happens next cycle. If Bitcoin does, you know, go to 500K, $1 million per coin, all of a sudden it's a $10 trillion market cap asset. And what's really interesting about this is when Bitcoin reaches a certain size, all of a sudden it becomes even less risky than it is today. Because if Bitcoin's at $1 million, that means it is big enough for the largest companies in the world to start indiscriminately allocating to Bitcoin. So for example, Michael Saylor is the perfect example of this. He's never selling Bitcoin. He's price agnostic. He's converting his whole balance sheet to Bitcoin. So you could kind of view the adoption of Bitcoin in MicroStrategy as a volatility accelerating and a volatility diminishing event. So Michael Saylor taking all the Bitcoin off exchanges, that accelerates Bitcoin's super cycle. But after a certain point in time, that's going to actually decrease the volatility because you have someone like Saylor buying, you know, $5, $10 million of Bitcoin every single month with his profits, and he's not selling it. So when I say it's volatility diminishing, that means eventually there's less sell pressure and there's only buy pressure. So like Michael Saylor says, it's going up forever, Laura. And I think that's what you do eventually see, because I believe when Bitcoin hits a price tag of $1 million, all of a sudden companies like Apple, Microsoft, who literally have over $200 billion of cash on their balance sheet, they are forced to make the decision and say, look, we need a 5% allocation to Bitcoin. Even let's be conservative, we need a 1% allocation to Bitcoin. I think there is like, there's 58,000 public companies. I mean, how much Bitcoin is on exchanges? There's 2 million Bitcoin. So that's only enough Bitcoin on exchanges for 11 people to buy more Bitcoin than Michael Saylor. So I think at a certain price point, it does make sense that you're not going to see these 80% corrections, because for every pleb like myself or you who might want to peel off 1 or 5 or 10% of our stack and sell it, there's going to be a buyer on the other side of that transaction who is buying Bitcoin forever and then never selling it. So once it's going on the balance sheet of Apple or Microsoft, they're going to copy what Michael Saylor did. They're never going to sell it because Bitcoin is superior money. That's my thoughts. What do you think about this idea of a super cycle and 80% corrections? I want to hear your thoughts, Brandon.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I don't think that this one's going to be a super cycle, and that might make me sound bearish because I got the bull tard over here, Luke. But the reason being is just, I think like we're still too much in the fiat world, right? I mean, I think, you know, the powers that be are going to print again. They're going to, which is causing more volatility in things like the jobs market and, you know, things like the consumer behavior. And I think you look at things like El Salvador is a perfect example. You know, it's been legal tender for what, like over 2 years now? It's going on the third year at this point. And if you go around El Salvador, if you go to anywhere outside of like El Zante, there's about like 10% of places, maybe 15% of places that accept Bitcoin, which 10 to 15% is a significant amount. So I don't want to discredit that by any means. But in places like the United States, that's less than 1%. And we're not close to having Bitcoin be legal tender. And I think in this next cycle, we won't have that either. So I think a lot of countries, like in Latin America, have a lot of room for growth and can make Bitcoin legal tender, can make a lot of transactions. And there's a lot of, you know, things kind of going back and forth in that. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of normies still want the dollar. They still kind of believe in that until we move to a place where it is the unit of count. Bitcoin sats are the unit of account. And we start looking at that as the exchange rate. You know, the plebs can do that and the plebs can hodl and do those kind of things. But I think we're still too much in this fiat cycle where we're going to be in a business cycle, which is going to get closer and closer. You know, I mean, if you look at the United States, right? I mean, since 2000, we had the dot-com boom and bust. We had 2008, we had the COVID boom and bust. So in this, like, you know, 2.5 decade period, we have essentially 3 major recessions. So I think that that's going to become more of a norm where we're going to have those, you know, occurrences come closer and closer until the system either, you know, fizzles out and we kind of have a transition that's slow and steady to Bitcoin, or we have one that, you know, completely breaks the system. And I think in order to have a super cycle, we kind of need to have that slow transition over into more of like a Bitcoin standard and kind of either using it as, you know, backing a fiat currency or backing a currency. So it's like instead of a dollar backed by gold, it's maybe a dollar backed by Bitcoin or something like that. But, you know, I think as it stands right now, we're still too ingrained into that fiat system where we see the volatility of, you know, just the business cycles in general, which will carry over into the Bitcoin cycle. So we, you know, I'm not banking on this being the last cycle necessarily, but it's not out of the realm of possibilities, right? I mean, I definitely think that there's going to be a chance. And I think, you know, as the price increases, we'll see the $1 million candles, but that'll be, you know, a lower percentage. So if you look at it as like, you know, the percentage moving, the volatility, you know, it, I think in a sense, it will be less volatile in the day to day, but you know, it'll kind of maybe climb up over time. So I don't know, does that sound absolutely crazy? Does that make, your, I guess, smoke coming out of your bowl come out or what?
I tell you what, I'm pretty bullish and I don't put up with any bearish pessimism, but I think you're right. Maybe we could talk about macro later on, because you said something I definitely agree with. And that is the fact that, macro is going to get more and more volatile and these recessions are going to get closer and closer together. I 100% agree with that. Maybe we can open that up in 5 minutes. But I wanted to comment on a big misconception about this super cycle or about, you know, Bitcoin going to these crazy numbers. I see a future in 2030, my base case. So my base case for 2030 is that Bitcoin is worth tens of millions of dollars per coin without hyperinflation. And Bitcoin adoption is still less than 2% globally. So I just believe that it's not going to take many people to actually send Bitcoin to these astronomical levels, because Bitcoin is a monetary technology. So that is something that I believe a lot of people miss when they're thinking about these $1 million or $5 million price tags with Bitcoin. They think, oh, but that kind of correlates to like a 20 or a 50% adoption of Bitcoin by the people. And I just don't think that's possible. I think price is set at the margin. That was the whole thesis of the Bitcoin double halving video I made. And it only takes a few Michael Saylors to buy the remaining Bitcoin sitting on exchanges before all of a sudden there's no Bitcoin on exchanges. And it only takes a very small amount of buy pressure to send Bitcoin to crazy prices. So 2 million Bitcoin on exchanges, that's enough Bitcoin for 11 Michael Saylors. And a lot of people have said to me, but Luke, Michael Saylor is this weird guy on his own. He's the only person, you know, employing this strategy. And I don't think so. Like, I think if you look out around the world, there's lots of people privately doing the exact same thing as Michael Saylor. So obviously you have Ricardo Salinas in Mexico, Mexico's second or third richest man. I believe he has more than 50% of his liquid net worth in Bitcoin. That number's changed and fluctuated. I think it rose from 10% in 2021. He learned more about Bitcoin. And in a 2023 interview, he said he was up to a 50% allocation to Bitcoin. We also have someone like Bill Miller. I believe he also has 50% of his net worth in Bitcoin. So you only really need 11 of these guys to copy what Michael Saylor's done. Like, Michael Saylor is not a big billionaire. Okay. He's only got $6 billion of capital under his management at MicroStrategy. So again, you only need, you know, six Michael Saylors to do what he's done. And all of a sudden you've got no Bitcoin on exchanges. So I think that's a really common misconception, but something I want to double down on. We can see Bitcoin at tens of millions of dollars per coin and still have global Bitcoin adoption lower than like 2%. And I don't think anybody has really thought about how all of that shakes out.
Yeah, I guess you're nailing that on the head. I mean, that's great, and I appreciate you clearing that up. But you mentioned the macro. Let's dive into it. So obviously, you know, we had the COVID boom and the bust. You know, we also had you know, kind of an interesting year in this past year. The S&P 500, for example, was gave more returns than the S&P 500 did in 2020. We also saw Bitcoin, you know, rise up over 120%, and a lot of you know, people were making money. But it seems like, you know, if you go on Twitter, maybe it's just all the bears out there on the overall like macro economy, right? We see the consumer showing signs of cracks, credit card debt at an all-time high. You know, a lot of things were suppressed in the United States, like student loan debt, what you didn't need to pay that back, personal savings going down, obviously inflation going up and being sticky, not necessarily transitory. So with all that being said, you know, what's your, I guess, overall outlook on the macro environment? I'll put you on the spot here. Like, do you think we're going to have a recession here fairly soon? Or do you think we're going to print our way out of it? Like, how do you see the next, I guess, 12 to 18 months playing out here?
We've already had the recession. So that's a provocative statement. But I can see why the bears are bearish. Like there's a few bears who are expecting an enormous crash coming this year. But I think there's lots of very interesting explanations for whether we're going to see a crash or not a crash. Some people believe we have already seen it, because in Q1 and Q2 2023, was that when US actually saw two negative quarters of negative GDP growth? And they came out and just said, yeah, sorry, that's not the definition of a recession anymore. We're changing our mind. So some people have said, hey, look, we've already had the recession. I also think there's a case to be made that the yield curve is giving us faulty signals, because for the first time in the past 80 years, we're watching global de-dollarization. So this isn't something I've thought about super deeply, but everybody's saying, look, every single time the yield curve has inverted in the past 80 years, we've seen a recession. The yield curve inverted in July 2022, I believe, from memory. They're saying, hey, look, where is our recession? Historically, we've seen a recession 13 months after a yield curve inversion. And it's now been 19 months, I believe, rough, you know, back of the napkin maths, since we saw that yield curve inversion. And the only, you know, two times in history that we've had to wait this long for a recession after a yield curve inversion was 1929, when I believe it was like an 18 or a 19 month wait between the yield curve inversion in 1928 and the largest crash in financial market history in 1929. And the other time that we had to wait a very long time for a yield curve inversion was in 2008, the second worst crash we've seen in the past 100 years, the global financial crisis. So the fact that we've had to wait 19 months for this recession that we still haven't seen by some people's definitions certainly makes me cautious. It makes me, you know, pay attention to what's going on. And I follow many of these perma bears on Twitter because I'm still watching this very interestingly, and I don't know exactly what's going to happen. But I suppose there's some arguments for why we could see an enormous crash, something bigger than 1929. My base case right now is the fact that these things like the BTFP are essentially just papering over the cracks of any sort of recession that we're going to see. Like, I believe the government's cooking the numbers. They're creating these facilities like the BTFP, which today is still hitting an all-time high, which kind of rescued the banking crisis in March of 2023. And again, even if we have a recession, I believe there's no assurance that Bitcoin's going to crash from that recession. So in the March 2023 banking crisis, Bitcoin pumped. Bitcoin ripped 55% in 3 weeks during that banking crisis, which was really interesting to see. Yeah, I don't know. I've said a lot there about the recession. What do you reckon? What do you think we see?
Yeah, man. I think that, you know, I think that we're going to start to see a recession here in the next maybe like 12-ish months. We're going to start to see a sign of, you know, maybe the economy pull back. You know, what I think is going to happen is obviously, you know, we saw Powell raise interest rates at a dramatic pace. I think we're going to wait. He's going to wait a little bit too late and start pulling back. You know, when there's already cracks in the surface, kind of starting to surface and things are not looking as good. And then that's when they're going to start to pull back. And, you know, historically, when we see interest rates pull back, it's not necessarily a good thing, which I think, you know, is kind of a big misconception that we've seen, you know, a lot on Twitter and in other places that people think once the interest rates pull back, there's going to be this massive influx in money. No. Usually when you see the interest rates pull back after a dramatic raise, you see a recession. And so I think that's kind of what we're going to see here is somewhat of a pullback causing a recession for this next, I don't know, maybe it'll be a shortened period and they'll get out of it through some QE, some quantitative easing, which, you know, a lot of people like to equate to money printing, but there's definitely other ways that they quote unquote print money and they find creative ways to do that, whether it's, you know, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, not have students pay back their student loan debt, which majority of that money is lent out by the government. So I think, you know, they're going to find creative ways to try to help people out in the short term. But in the long term, it's just always just kicking the can down the road. I don't think that this is going to be the big massive recession. I don't think we're at that tipping point just yet, because I think that the powers that be do not want to lose that power just yet. So they're going to do everything that they can in order to keep that. And so, you know, because of all those factors, I think, you know, it's just going to make this like little bump, or kind of keep climbing up with this national debt until all of a sudden we collapse. And I don't think we're to that collapsing point just yet, but I think we're working towards it, unfortunately. But, you know, that's why we need Bitcoin to kind of hold for that hedge, right?
We do. And you said something really interesting there. I want to dive down. You're 100% correct. Every single time the Fed cuts interest rates, it's bad for the markets. The Fed is cutting interest rates for a reason. They can see the economy is slowing. They can see businesses are not making as much money. So typically, every single time that you look back in history over the past 50 years, whenever the Fed cuts rates, that's bad. And we typically see a stock market crash after the Fed cuts interest rates. But I'm again one of the guys who thinks this time is different, because I think the Fed is doing things differently this time. Normally you see the Fed cut interest rates, markets crash, then the Fed brings out the bazooka of money printing to save the markets from crashing. But I think this time is already different, because the Fed kind of had a money printer bazooka in their program BTFP. You know, there's a lot of argument. Is that QE? Is it not QE? I don't see how it's not yield curve inversion, because they're saying to these banks who are holding these toxic treasuries, they're saying, hey, look, yes, you have a lot of losses on your balance sheet from these treasuries, but you can just, we're essentially going to buy them off you at par. So that's essentially kind of stopping the bond market from selling off aggressively, forcing these banks from marking those losses to their balance sheet. So I don't know. I know some people will disagree with that, especially some people in the macro space. But I think we're watching signs that things are already a little bit different. The Fed, I think the Fed's already doing QE, and I don't know what's going to happen next. I've like predicting macro right now in 2023. It is only going to become harder and harder, because I believe that all of the old traditional signals are not working in the 2020s. And that is because I believe we're living through the deleveraging of an 80-year long-term debt cycle. This was an article I wrote, like a stupidly long 8,000-word article on the long-term debt cycle in 2021. And I was making the case that no, inflation is not transitory at 3%, which it was at the time. I made the case that inflation on average is going to be much higher for the decade of the 2020s, because governments need debt to inflate away. They need inflation to inflate away their debt. And like, if you look back throughout history, every single time a government reaches 130% debt to GDP ratio, it's an absolute train wreck. And this is part of my mental model for why I believe Bitcoin can hit tens of millions of dollars per coin by 2030. I'm not only looking at Bitcoin as it being a monetary technology going through an exponential phase of adoption. You also have its competitor, fiat, getting exponentially worse in the decade of 2020s. So again, the US hit 139% debt to GDP in 2020. And historically, Hirschman Capital done a phenomenal report looking at the solvency of governments throughout history. So over the past 250 years, Hirschman Capital determined that there was 51 occasions when a government hit 130% debt to GDP ratio. And out of those 52 times, governments defaulted on their debt 51 of those 52 times within 15 years of them reaching that 130% debt to GDP. So essentially, we got 15 years from 2020 before we expect to see an American default on their debt. And obviously, you can default on your debt through inflation, hyperinflation, outright collapse. But obviously, things could be a little bit different with the US because they're the global reserve currency. I understand all of those arguments, but I would raise you and say, hey, look, there's another 11 countries around the world with debt to GDP ratios of above 130%. So the global financial system is over indebted as a whole. It's globally interconnected. And if you have 1, 2, 9, or 11 countries trying to fight this deleveraging phase and period, I believe the global economy is going to look very different to what it has looked like over the past 40 or 50 years when we saw this debt accumulation. All of a sudden, we're in a period of time where the world is deglobalizing and it's trying to, you know, deleverage itself. So I have controversial opinions. I think the 2020s are going to be super, super unpredictable. I don't even remember the original question you asked me, Brandon. I'm sorry. I just get lost in rabbit holes when I'm talking about macro. But I hope I provided some sort of value with that long-winded answer.
No, you definitely did, my friend. You definitely did. But we talked about the bull cycle in 25, right? I mean, we're recording this on January 9th in 24. So before I let you go, I got to get your prediction for the rest of this year and why you think the bull cycle is going to be delayed for one more year. Why do you think that 24, is it going to be a slow drag up? Like, what do you think is happening for this calendar year?
Yeah. So again, send me a hate mail. I don't do short-term price predictions on Bitcoin. I do feel very strongly about the fact that Bitcoin is going to be worth tens of millions by 2030. So that's something, that's a prediction I stand behind and I've stood behind it since 2021. But short-term price prediction, let's have some fun. I think like typically the year of the halving is a little bit slower. So I think it's really interesting that Bitcoin's already at like $48,000 3 months before the halving. Like that, I believe that's nearly a record. Bitcoin's never hit an all-time high before its halving. So again, if it takes its all-time high before the halving, like Adam Back believes it might, that's going to be a first. But I don't see any crazy prices in 2024. I think you need to let the halving kind of do its thing, kind of, you know, do its mojo. Maybe by the end of 2024, we're sitting at a pretty humble $85,000 per coin. Maybe Bitcoin's, you know, had a crack at 100,000 and, you know, it's a big key psychological number. Many people were saying Bitcoin's topped at, you know, $100,000 per coin. And I think 2025 is when things get really interesting. I think that's when, you know, the supply suffocation has really kind of penetrated the network, so to say. That's typically when you see the craziest years for Bitcoin. It's normally Bitcoin peaks about, is it 12 to 18 months after the halving? So that should put us up for a peak of Bitcoin somewhere around, you know, April 2025 to like October, November 2025. So yeah, a humble 85,000 for the end of 2024, maybe with a peak price of 110. Let's say we breach 110, we have a little correction to 85. And at the end of the year, and then 2025, we go crazy.
Yeah, I agree with you though too. But yeah, I mean, I've noticed that too as well. You know, everybody puts a lot of pressure on the halving. You know, we're not going to see a huge price jump on that day necessarily. You know, and it's become more and more delayed. The top has become more and more delayed every cycle. So I agree with you 100%. I think we're going to probably see the all-time high in 25. But obviously, that's all not financial advice. And we're here just a couple bulletards. Maybe one's a little bit more bulletard than the other. But we're just here, just very bullish on what's months ahead. So, Luke, I appreciate you coming in with me and explaining a little bit of this craziness and what we got going on. But why don't you tell everybody where they could find you and what all you got going on?
Yeah, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot of comments in today's video telling me I'm crazy bullish. And that's fine. You can give Brandon those comments. You can also tell me on Twitter why I'm crazy. My Twitter handle is just my name. I've got a YouTube channel where I'm going live nearly every day talking about Bitcoin and why nobody's bullish enough on Bitcoin. If you want help growing a YouTube channel, that's something I think I try my hardest to specialize in. So if you want help growing a YouTube channel, reach out to me. I also help you grow Twitter if you want to. But yeah, that's me, man. You can find me online. Tell me I'm crazy. It's an absolute pleasure joining you today, Brandon. I think this was number two that we've done. So thanks again for having me. I hope it was a blast.
Yeah, of course, man. You're always welcome back. And I highly recommend Luke for helping out. He's helped my YouTube. And if you guys have noticed the intros and the thumbnails and everything else looking a lot better, Luke's been amazing at that. So I couldn't give the green candle stamp of approval for anybody else but Luke. So thanks so much, man. And yeah, we'll have to have you back on again at sometime in the near future.
I'm absolutely looking forward to it, man. It would be an absolute honor.